Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Mountain Money is a business show, and most weeks we focus on topics relating to traditional for-profit businesses. But religion actually shares many characteristics with traditional big business. It must recruit, it must raise funds, disperse budgets, manage facilities, and get its message out. So, is religion alive and well in the 21st century? How should we understand the power that religion has accumulated and in some instances abused? And where are things likely to go from here? This morning, we're lucky to be joined by economist Paul Seabright, who's written a fascinating new book, The Divine Economy, How Religions Compete for Wealth, Power, and People. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, I'm very pleased to be here on the show.
So, Kevin, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Well, about 20 years ago, I wrote a book about how we can trust complete strangers, which is a pretty important thing to do in the world today. It was called The Company of Strangers, The Natural History of Economic Life. And a friend of mine, a labor economist called Giuseppe Bertola, read it and said to me, you know, Paul, I quite like your book, but somehow the people in it are, it's all a bit abstract. They lack passion. You know, they interact in a very reasonable way, but the passion is missing. And in particular, they're not gendered. They don't have a gender. They don't have a sexuality. And the other thing they're missing is ideology and beliefs. They don't have any religion. And, you know, I said, Giuseppe, you're so right. And so I spent the next 20 years thinking about those two things. The first 10 of those 20 years were mostly researching the economics of gender and how gender affects social trust. And the next 10 years, so the last 10 years, were mostly spent thinking about how religion affects social trust. And that's how I sort of came at it. I didn't start thinking of religion as a set of ideas in themselves, or I didn't start thinking of it as, you know, part of the culture wars. I just started thinking of it as a thing that helps to weave trust between people.
In order to write the book, you needed to define the word religion. How did you define that?
Well, religion isn't one thing. I think that's the really most important thing to get a handle on. Religion is a whole bunch of different activities, but what unites them is that they're based around the conviction that the people undertaking them are interacting with invisible spirits of some kind. Okay? Now, people think of those invisible spirits in different ways. In some religions, they're very, very abstract. In some, they're really down to earth and practical, and they're individuals that you can sort of speak to and ask questions of. And the important thing about those individual spirits is that they act in the world, and so they make a difference to our well-being. And they're not deaf to us. They can be influenced by things we do, by our entreaties and by our prayers. But, you know, around that, we construct a whole bunch of different activities. They may be social activities, they may be ritual activities, they may involve beliefs, they may not involve beliefs. It's the presence of those invisible spirits in the minds of the faithful that unites all those different activities together.
Now, early on in the book, you described the distinction between transcendental and immanent religious beliefs, something I found fascinating. Can you explain what the distinction is and why it's significant?
Sure. I mean, the distinction isn't really mine. It goes back to an old idea that historians in the 19th century thought about and described. But basically, you can think of the immanent religious beliefs as being based around the idea that there's a whole bunch of spirits around us, and our relationship with them is pretty transactional. So, you know, I've got backache. I want it to be cured. Or, you know, I've got a business venture, and I want to make sure it's successful. And you know, if you went out into the marketplace in ancient Athens or in ancient Rome, you had a whole bunch of people offering to facilitate your transaction with these invisible spirits. So they might be astrologers, they might be necromancers, they might be offering sacrifices. One of the things I loved reading about in ancient Greece was what they call curse tablets. So, you know, if you're really stuck and your life is going badly and you know, everybody is just dumping on you, you can buy curse tablets, which will bring down the curses on those people that you have no other way of influencing. And, you know, that still exists today in lots of parts of the world. I mean, even including predominantly Christian parts of the world. If you go to Lourdes in southwest France, you know, people are going there because they have aches and pains, because they may have serious illnesses. They want something in return for their prayers, their entreaties, and usually their money. Transcendental religion was something which arose, well, at different points in time, and people argue about it, but somewhere between about 800 BC and about 300 BC, and gave us what we now think of as the big world religions, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and so on, but also others like Zoroastrianism. And, you know, some people have located it way back in ancient Egypt. So there was Akhenaten, an emperor who had the cult of the sun. There was also the cult of Osiris, who was a god who claimed to be able to save people's souls. So when you died, it was said that your soul was weighed in the scales, and if it was lighter than a feather, because it hadn't accumulated too many sins, then you could be saved and go on to the afterlife. And if it was too heavy with sins and it weighed more than a feather, then you would not go on to the afterlife. But basically, what all of these transcendental religions did was they offered some hope of personal salvation. And it could be salvation in this life, but at the beginning, not really. Or it could be salvation in some future life in some way. And so in those transcendental religions, they're much bigger in scope. They tell a big story about where we are in the world. They usually have a strong moral component. They often have a doctrinal component. And they also believe that most of the time we have to manage our own affairs. The immanent ones are really transactional. They don't go in for philosophy. They basically are about, you do a deal, you make an offering, a sacrifice, and you get something in return.
And for the purposes of the book, a lot of what you've been looking at is that transcendental religious beliefs.
Yes.
Now,
that's right. Yeah, go on.
I was going to say, now we're spending this time to talking about religious beliefs and religion in general. And I think in North America, I read, you know, in the book, in Europe, many of us believe that religion is on the decline. Is that true worldwide?
Absolutely not. No. If you look at just about all of the measures that you can get about the importance of religion in people's lives, and, you know, I spend quite a lot of time in the book looking at that, comparing different regions and so on, across the world on average, they're basically not moving. There are some places, some countries where it's declining, and it's interesting to ask why. So North America is one of those places, parts of Western Europe too, but even in some other parts of the world, in Chile, for example, in Latin America, but also in some parts of the Islamic world. So in Iran, the importance that people attach to religion seems to be declining. There are a number of other places, but there are lots of places in the world where it's increasing. So pretty well everywhere that in the Orthodox Christian world, which were mainly countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, those are countries where religion's been increasing importance, and actually not just the Orthodox countries. So Poland, for example, a very Catholic country, has seen a huge increase in the importance of religion, but also right across Africa and Asia. And it's not just one type of religion. So many Buddhist countries, it's become more important. Religion's growing in importance in China. And if you sort of add those up and take an average, basically on average, it's not moving. It's going up in some places, down in some places, but it's absolutely not moving overall.
In the book, you talk about a little bit about how religions gain their power. Can you sort of give us a broad sense of that?
Well, I think basically they gain their power by offering people something which the ordinary secular world doesn't give them. And you can describe that in lots of ways, but I think in a word, I'd say it's a sense of community. Because when people join religious movements, and this is true whether they're very small local movements or whether they're big world movements, what they get out of their membership is, it can be many things. It can be a sense of spiritual peace. It can be involvement in ritual and so on. But they do all of that as part of a community. And what happens is that the successful movements have proved very good at building communities that have all of the elements that make people feel a part of it, including the ability to contribute. You know, we tend to think in our sort of secular consumer world that you're satisfied if you get stuff, if people give you things, if you consume, if you obtain. But what a lot of religious movements have really understood, and understood in a very subtle and deep way, is that what we need also is to give. We need to be able to give to others. And if we don't give to others, we feel empty. And the most successful religious movements have understood that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You start the book by talking about a woman named Grace in Ghana. And share a little bit with the audience about how that reflects what you were just talking about, this notion of getting to give something.
Yeah, so I was very moved in research I was doing a few years ago in Ghana, in Accra, when I met this young woman. I call her Grace. I don't want to use her real name. She was about 24 years old. She came to where my researchers and I were doing surveys and interactions with a number of people from her church. And, you know, when I looked at her, she was simply dressed, but well-spoken, and I thought she's probably got a reasonable education and maybe she's working in a government office or in a small business. But I was completely wrong. She has a terrible job. She sells iced water in little plastic packets from a basket over her head. And she does that by walking up and down between the traffic that's backed up at the traffic lights on the highway coming into Accra, the capital of Ghana. And she spends 12 hours a day walking up and down between the cars, inhaling the exhaust fumes, being shouted at and abused by people who are just treating her horribly. And in the evening, she goes home to a tiny little shack in a shanty town that she and her aunt have built. And so she has a terrible time 6 days a week. And then on day seven, she goes to church. And we figured out that she earns practically nothing. We, in 2015, we calculated that she earned $1.50 a day. And she gives about 12% of that income to a church, a Pentecostal church, whose pastor is incredibly rich. He wears a dollar sign on the buckle of his belt, and he has very well-pressed suits, and he's a big, smiling, charming man. He drives a Mercedes. He wants everybody to know he's very rich. So I start with this puzzle. Why would this very poor woman give this very rich man so much money? And it sounds like she's being abused and exploited, and she doesn't realize something. But she does. She's very smart. She's very lucid. And she's much more lucid about her finances than I am about mine. And part of what she gets out of it is that she goes to this place where she's treated with respect. So first thing is, you go into the church, and she's an usher. She's showing people to their seat. She's a Sunday school superintendent. She sings in the choir. She can wear a decent dress. She's treated one day a week with respect. And, I talk about lots of other things that she might get. There's quite likely that this is the best place she'll maybe be able to find her husband and so on and so forth. But the important point is she's treated with respect, and giving is part of what makes her feel respected. If she can't give, she feels lost. And I think that's a really important lesson. You know, our secular society is all about getting. What I think these platforms have understood is that real fulfillment is also about giving.
Okay, and I guess to follow up on that, this sort of leads into something you call the platform model. Can you explain that?
Mm. Okay, so platforms are basically organizations that create or facilitate relationships which couldn't form so easily or couldn't function so easily without them. And of course, in the modern world, we think about platforms as we think of things like, Google and Facebook and so on, and they're these big digital things. But, platforms have been around since the dawn of history. And, if you think about interpreters, you think about market traders, you think about people who function, you think about matchmakers in, old agricultural communities where, somebody needed to introduce the family of the groom to the family of the bride. And these are all platforms that used pre-digital technology. And so we shouldn't forget that, because we tend to think of platforms as digital things. But basically, religious communities are platforms in the sense that they bring people together, and they bring people together in very sophisticated ways. And so a lot of my book is about describing the many sophisticated ways in which religious movements do that. And of course, the platform model, it has to function. I mean, I say, these are businesses, and they need revenues, and they need to cover their costs, and their costs are sometimes big. And so how do they do that? They do that by taking share of the value that those relationships create. I don't know if that's clear, but essentially, platforms are communities that can only function because of the way in which the platform has enabled people to come together.
And also, you talk about, at one point in the book, you sort of draw a distinction between supply and demand forces. And again, a classic set of economist terms. Can you explain how that fits in this context?
Okay, so I mean, I spent a chapter saying, okay, what do people want out of religion? And of course, the answer is it's not one thing. And much as I said, you know, there's if you try to define religion as one kind of thing, then you get stuck. If you accept that it's a bunch of diverse activities, but they have a point in common, then I think you're much more on track. And so similarly, what are the things people want out of religion? Well, it's many, many things. You know, sometimes they want very concrete material stuff. I mean, so, you know, I talk about how people, they need help with their finances. They need help looking after their kids. They need solutions to their health problems. They need, but sometimes it's more abstract things. It's they need to feel part of a community, and that can be helped by being given rituals. And the rituals can be good for their peace of mind, but they can also be good for their sense of belonging. And clearly some people also want a story about, you know, where are we in the world? Why is life so tough? Why do decent people so often suffer? You know, what is it all about? Why am I struggling all of my life just so that other people can get rich off the back of me? What is it all for? And you may like them or you may loathe them, but religious movements tell people a story about that, about why you're not alone, about why your life isn't pointless. And so, you know, there's all of these different demands. They can be very practical and very material, but they can also be very abstract. They can be moral. They can be social. And the point is that these communities can supply all of those together. So you can both go to a community which looks after you when you're sick, so it's giving you healthcare, but it's not just giving you healthcare, because it's also sending people who will listen to you and listen to you about the fears that your sickness creates and your sense that your life is worthless or meaningless. And I think you can't see the things that people want out of religion if you don't see it as a package. It's not just the individual elements of the package, it's the way the whole package fits together.
How has the relationship between religion and political power evolved?
Well, you know, a very long time ago in prehistory, as far as we can tell, most of the first powerful kings and emperors basically liked to proclaim themselves gods, or sometimes they would get other, you know, tame priests to do that for them, because they understood something which still lots of political leaders today care about, which is that they understood that, you know, religions have a lot of legitimacy because they persuade people. And so if you are a member of a religious community and the people that you follow in that religious community are people you trust, well, you know, political leaders would like some of that legitimacy, and they're very envious of the legitimacy that the religious movements can bring about. And so the fact that they're envious means that they do all sorts of things to try to piggyback on that legitimacy. And sometimes they do it by bribing the religious leaders to, you know, I mean, literally, they will. I mean, the Spanish, the Catholic Church under Franco was essentially under the control of the Franco regime, but, you know, the Franco regime basically paid all the priests and, you know, paid for the costs of all the religious buildings and the repairs to the churches and so on. And, you know, who wouldn't want that? It's very attractive. But of course, part of what happens when you do that is that gradually all of the reasons why the religious movement gained legitimacy with the faithful start to disappear, because people say, well, you know, once upon a time my priests really worked for me, but now I see they've just become, you know, functionaries of the government, and they're just there to peddle the political message of the authoritarian leaders. So, you know, this is an old idea. It goes back to stuff that Adam Smith wrote in the 18th century, in which he said there's a kind of life cycle of religious movements. When the religious movements are young and vigorous, the political leaders envy them. They say, wow, we would really like to have these people preaching to their members on our behalf. And so they get in and they try and, you know, sometimes they use flattery and sweet talk and persuasion. Sometimes they use authoritarian tactics, but they basically try to get the religious leaders on their side. And that usually works for a bit. And then gradually the faithful start to lose their reverence for the religious leaders because they see they've just become political lackeys. And so that kind of cycle, you see it in the world today. I mean, you see it in, You see it in Iran, where, you know, there was a huge surge in religiosity at the late under the Shah, and when the regime of Ayatollah Khomeini first arrived. And gradually, as the Iranian regime came to exploit Islam for its own authoritarian purposes, the Iranian population has become very cynical and very unwilling to accept that religion is actually legitimate, because it's been so much exploited by the political authorities.
Okay, we have about 2 minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about the future. What do you see as the future of religion as a force?
Well, it's not going away. I think that's the important thing we need to understand. And, you know, we haven't talked yet about why religion has been perceived to be declining in the U.S., and that may be for another day. And if your readers are interested, there's quite a lot of stuff I discuss in the book about that. But if you're sitting in North America and you see, increasing secularism and more and more people saying that they have no religion, you probably think it's about to disappear. Well, mm-hmm. It isn't. That I can say. You know, there are reasons for what's happening in the U.S., but in the rest of the world, it isn't. And I think the answer to that is that it will continue to change and evolve. There's been no shortage of people since the ancient times, but certainly since the 19th century, saying, well, you know, as countries get richer, people are going to be able to do without religion. That's just not true. And the reason it's not true is that even if people can outgrow the particular forms of religion they grew up with, religious movements are very dynamic and they're very innovative and they adapt to the new circumstances. So, you know, Pentecostal and evangelical forms of Protestant Christianity, for example, have really innovated and evolved their structure and their functioning and the kind of services they offer to adapt themselves to the modern world. So whether it's in the U.S. or whether it's in Africa and in Asia, where, you know, there are huge populations still in Africa and Asia. They're migrating from the countryside to the cities. They leave their communities, fairly tight-knit communities in the countryside. They arrive in the cities. They don't know anybody. They feel lost. And those communities can offer them a home, and a home in sort of the very best of senses, that's a home not just to help them get housed and maybe find work, but also a home in the sense of somewhere where they feel right, where they feel good, and where they feel that they're appreciated and valued. And, you know, the religious movements of all kinds are not going to go away. And that's although they've got huge problems. I mean, we haven't talked about things like sexual abuse in religious movements, which happen in all movements worldwide. And more as social media bring these things out into the open, people are going to question, you know, why does it happen and so on. But the movements will adapt. And I think anybody who thinks religion is disappearing in the 21st century is going to be surprised.
We've been speaking with Paul Seabright about his new book, The Divine Economy, How Religions Compete for Wealth, Power, and People. Paul, thanks for joining us.
On May 16th, Mountain West Capital Network held their 29th annual Deal Flow event and revealed the 2023 Deal Flow Report. The Deal Flow Report is Utah's only in-depth publication that tracks equity-related financial transactions throughout the state. Joining us to share more about the contents of the report are Matt Bartholomew and Kevin Jessup with the Mountain West Capital Network. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here.
Yeah, our pleasure. Thank you.
The Deal Flow Report tracks equity-related transactions. Can you describe what an equity-related transaction is and why it's important to track?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the movement of money or capital flow is essential for any economy. You know, borrowing money to grow a business is crucial. When we talk about equity-related transactions, we're looking at situations where owners give up some of their business ownership in exchange for help or assistance to grow. This might mean selling a small stake to buy new equipment, you know, maybe expand the team. It might even mean bringing in new owners to push the business forward. We're particularly interested in, you know, when Utah business owners give up part of their stake so others can join in the successes and the challenges. You know, tracking these ownership changes in Utah helps us understand who is investing in the state, who are the repeat entrepreneurs, who are the investors taking risks in different industries, It gives us an insight into what's working, especially in a somewhat slow economy that we've had over the past 18 months. Successful businesses show that the efforts of Utah's entrepreneurs and investors are paying off, and they're getting noticed both locally and globally.
I want to ask you a question that you may not have an easy answer to, but you know, as I read this and I see the activity going on, it feels like Utah is a relatively vibrant place for business activity and for these kinds of equity deals. Do you have any sense of how we compare to other states? And like I said, you may not know the answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, like, it feels like, I mean, especially when you look at the accolades we're receiving in national news,
exactly,
you know, how well Utah's economy is doing. We're doing, you know, far above average. But to be honest, you know, we don't have the ability to track that information because there aren't a lot of others, you know, in some ways, because there aren't a lot of other states that produce a report like this one.
That's,
you know,
what I was asking.
The investment,
exactly,
in their states.
Wow.
Yeah. And if I may, I share the nature of the industries that are being invested in as well, right? So you have a lot of industries that are in other states that are very much focuses of those other states. Whereas, we certainly have software tech, as well as healthcare that kind of lead the way, so to speak, but you find, you know, industrial to consumer product companies. So our economy here is very vibrant in terms of the amount of industries that have grown to a level of where there's investment coming in into those industries that you don't see as much, I would say, in other states.
So the 2023 report, the average value of the mergers and acquisitions showed a significant increase over the previous period. Matt, can you explain what you found and maybe what you attribute the change to?
Yes, absolutely. No, I appreciate the question. So, I mean, we both found in 2023 there was volume. So you touched on value. So there's volume and value. So one, there was overall a higher amount of volume, just the sheer count amount of merchant acquisitions happened in 23 over the year 22. And it's important for us to caveat when we talk about value that we don't have a perfect set of data here, right? A lot of this is just we depend upon what's disclosed when we look at this data. So it's not a perfect set of data to compare and contrast year over year, but it is informative, it is directional, I would say. So when you look at 23, we absolutely had certain transactions that were just in sheer size, fairly large when you look at the, even over the last 3 to 5 years within the state of Utah. One, Extra Space Storage had a tremendous merger and acquisition with another similar business called Life Storage. And then you also had Qualtrics, which basically went from being a publicly listed company that we could buy and sell their stock to a privately held business, with both those transactions being valued over $10 billion. You also had three transactions that were larger than the largest one that occurred in 21. You know, so 2021 was a global hype for merger and acquisition activity, but the third largest merger and acquisition, which was Swire Coca-Cola for $3.5 billion, was larger than the largest one we had here in the state in 2021. So you had a lot of value. So you go up and down, you go all the way through to the fifth largest. When I look at, you know, just looking at the data right now, the fifth largest in value for 2023 was almost larger than the largest we saw in 2022, with Williams Pipelines at $1.5 billion. The largest in 22 was $1.8 billion. So in the end, the sheer size of value that we had within some of the larger businesses in the state, and I think it just shows, like, as we continue to grow and evolve as a state, and these larger businesses within the state continue to evolve, that this sheer size of value that's being transacted in our state will continue to grow in a similar fashion that we saw in 23.
One thing I want to understand just a little bit, there was some significant value, as you said. Did we see those companies moving out of Utah, or was the value maintained within the state?
No, so we don't see any of those companies moving kind of quote unquote out of state. Those are really transactions where it's been to bolster kind of what's being done. I would say maybe the only one that maybe had some of the implication would be you know, the NRG transaction where they bought Vivint Smart Home based in Provo. So I imagine there was some back office. And again, I'm just speaking kind of off the cuff here, but when I think about the top five, I would say that's the one where you might see some back office roles that were being effectively transferred into that Texas-based business energy that purchased Vivint Smart Home. But by and large, usually those dollars that come into the business just allow for broader expansion of service and capabilities that benefit everyone.
It seems
early on.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
You know, early on, we've been tracking this deal flow information since 1996. And for that first 5 to 10 years, it seemed like there was a net migration out of the state of Utah, you know, Utah's companies and that kind of thing. But we've really seen that reverse as both the deal flow community has grown and especially, you know, Utah's business has become bigger and stronger under most often the acquirers in these transactions.
You know, it seems like we can't have a discussion about current trends in business without talking about artificial intelligence. Can you give us a sense of the extent to which we saw the role of artificial intelligence in some of these transactions?
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable. I think, see, you know, with AI being more and more prominent over the past 3-4 years, and we look at when these companies were founded that transacted in 2023, we saw 19 AI-related businesses that had investment coming in some form. The vast majority of those were minority investments into those business. Really pretty incredible, like I said, 19 in total that we saw within the data we captured. But these businesses range from doing autonomous workstation development, transportation management, their software development with that machine learning to help improve worker safety, better and better learning and educational platforms, drug discovery platforms, meaning those kind of platforms are helping to use AI in a way to unlock better and safer medication to treat disease and ailment, better electronic healthcare record. Anyway, there's just some incredible work that's being done that, like I mentioned, I mean, really what you're seeing here for the majority of these transactions are a minority investment where funds are really coming into the business to help further growth and development of those cutting-edge businesses.
Tech and software previously drove the state's investment. What did the report tell you this year?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think, you know, that you can get a little wonky around the nature of how you categorize some of these businesses, because I think when you talk to a lot of business services, right, so maybe one business is providing service to another business, you know, 7-8 years ago, we might be talking about that business being really, you know, person-to-person or the delivery of those services were, kind of an in-person nature, whereas tech has enabled, what you hear about a lot of these businesses are, they're called quote-unquote tech-enabled businesses. So whether that's tech-enabled because of a certain innovation or certain product that's allowing that, or there's a software as a service component. So a lot of these business services, like let's take a healthcare company that's tech-enabled now that allows for remote healthcare service. Like you're talking to your doctor or nurse online, for example. So sometimes you look at these businesses and say, oh, what kind of services did it perform before? And what's being really enabled now through a innovative technology kind of solutions platform that really kind of characterizes it from our perspective as a tech or software business, albeit kind of the underlying end market or end consumer is kind of something that you might have characterized a little bit differently 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, if that makes sense. So absolutely, we'll continue to see this kind of trend. This is a trend we've been seeing for a number of years in terms of tech and software leading the way in terms of overall transactions. But I just think you have this ecosystem now where you have, you know, those that have come before that provide incredible coaching, mentors, and then those same mentors and coaches that have had transactions or maybe perhaps sold their business in the past in that space that put their own capital money at risk, and they just kind of accelerate what's been built over the last couple decades into further and further evolve kind of that tech and software industry here in the state. And you will not see a slowdown of that in my mind.
You know, here in the state of Utah, we've in 2023, from what we've tracked, 43% of the deals were in technology software space, which includes AI, of course, and then 15% each for both consumer retail and then 15% for, you know, healthcare related companies. So certainly tech is leading the way.
And just out of curiosity, what were some of the larger transactions that were in low tech, you know, sort of any manufacturing, any, you know, people that build stuff?
extra space storage is, you know, comes immediately to mind.
Right. That's a classic.
How do you get more basic than storage?
Yeah, yeah. No, so there is still activity on that side. You know, the deal flow report, you know, obviously covers private placements. Can you just explain to the audience what a private placement is and how you get that information?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's intended to relay that these are really private individuals and investment firms that have studied businesses. They meet the management teams to understand the nature of the business model, the ownership team, the management team. And then they end up purchasing a minority stake in some form or fashion in the business, which obviously, like we all touched on earlier, enables the business to put that money to work. And whether that's a startup stage or later stages of the business growth cycle. So when we kind of talk about private placements, it's really within that, you know, the average listener should think of it as just a minority part of the business being ownership being purchased. And so how do we obtain those details? So those details, we actually use compilers of that data. So there's a service called PitchBook as well as Capital IQ. So we'll really start there because those services, they kind of scrub through a lot of required government filings and that's required for like pretty much any transaction. And then we track and publish that data we receive as well as scrub it and understand it. Also, we collaborate closely with a lot of Utah-based lawyers, bankers, advisors, and others that can share a certain amount of the deals that they're participating in, where they're the service provider or part of that overall process that are occurring here in the state of Utah. And so to be clear, like the book captures investments made into all of those Utah-based businesses with the private placements being really should be thought of as just purchasing in some form a minority stake into that business.
That makes sense. The report also highlighted that 5 Utah companies had public offerings. Was there anything significant regarding these deals? And are 5 offerings about average for Utah per year?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because it is a lower point of activity over the last few years. So I think when we look back, there were 7 public transactions, so to speak, in 2022 and 19 and 2021. So when we talk about public offerings like this broader space, we're talking about an ability to be on a listing where an average person can be able to go out and purchase stock of that business. And that's just kind of a broad description. But there's advantages and disadvantages in how a company accesses new money and capital. And part of this trend can be explained in my mind in terms of businesses seeking investment from private investors like private equity in lieu of quote unquote going public or accessing the public markets. But there's also a broader trend that we've seen nationally around just being there being lower levels of companies accessing the public markets from 22, like I said, was 7. This year it's 5 for us here in the state of Utah, but it's just at a lower point right now. But I would say like what we saw was significant in terms of $0.25 billion being accessed through the public markets for, you know, incredible healthcare related firms such as Myriad Genetics, Recursion Pharmaceuticals, Clean Nanomedicine. There's also the kind of a healthcare manufacturing adjacent business in Syntex Technologies, and they have an AI solutions provider in Omnic. So of those 5 companies I just mentioned, that like I said, all of them had a public transaction in 2023, and you continue to see incredible developments that come out of those businesses.
You know, you may have alluded to this in your last answer, but isn't what we're seeing here somewhat consistent with a larger national trend of where companies are staying private longer, you know, sort of raising venture money then going to a private equity model rather than going straight to a public offering? Is that consistent?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's right. And it just depends on a myriad of factors on why a company wants to go public versus accessing private equity and partnering with a private equity firm in lieu of going public. I'm certainly not an investment banker that can speak much better better about these kind of things. But that being said, it's absolutely a national trend. As you go look back to 22 and 23 and even into the first quarter of 24, it's just at a lower level nationally. So I wouldn't say from a volume perspective that we are any different than what the broader trend that we're seeing nationally.
Exactly.
You've done a great job of explaining a lot of the components of the report. Can you let the listeners know where they can find out more about Mountain West Capital Network's report?
You know, we've got some great resources online. You can go to mwcn.org, stands for, you know, this is the acronym Mountain West Capital Network, and you can either see the pull-down menu that goes straight to deal flow, and you click on 2023 to see the most recent, you know, PDF version of the report, or, you know, if you just go to mwcn.org/deal flow, you'll get to the same spot. You know, on that website, we've got a dynamic interface where you can see, you know, these data findings. You can track it year over year because we've got not just the latest year, but all of the years, well, I don't know how far back, but, you know, back beyond a decade where you can see trends and that kind of information. You know, pulling this together annually is really a labor of love, you know, highlight the vibrant economic state we enjoy. I mean, it takes a lot of work, and we're all volunteers to, you know, collect this information. But we think it's valuable for the state. The state, you know, certainly looks very closely at the information we have, and we have regular requests from lots of folks out of state for this information as well.
Well, we've been taking time and speaking with Matt Bartholomew and Kevin Jessup with the Mountain West Capital Network. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks so very much.
Thank you.
Dad Bod Bootcamp taps into a major health crisis facing men today. Over 76 million men across the country are currently living with preventable diseases that our program, or their program, is uniquely positioned to help address. Joining us this morning to share more about Dad Bod Bootcamp is Parkite David Greenholz. David, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks for being here, and I'm looking forward to my shift right afterwards as well.
Well, it's nice to see you on the other side of the desk. The Dad Bod Bootcamp was launched after you had a much-needed towel snap moment. Do you want to go through and talk to the audience about kind of what process you were going through when this idea came about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, men's health is a journey. First off, Dad Bod Bootcamp is, just so everyone knows, is a text-based program to help men in coaching with losing weight, reducing their alcohol, and just feeling overall better. For me, about 3 years ago, coming out of COVID, like so many of us, I was basically eating what I want, drinking, and putting on a lot of weight, and just not exercising as well. And I think a lot of us through their life, it's a journey, and I've had weight issues on and off. I'm in shape, I'm out of shape, but nothing has really stuck. So that's what was going on with me and my partner in the business, Ian Ziering. You guys may know him from 90210, and if you're in the younger generation, you'll know him from Sharknado. But he came out on a trip and saw me, and he said, oh, you got to do something, and really held me accountable. And it was the first time where it wasn't a doctor, a nutritionist, or someone, your buddy. That's it. It's really that simple. And we were going on a trip a few months later, and he made a challenge to me. He said, all right, well, don't drink until we go on that trip. And I stuck to it. And that started a process for us of texting on a daily basis, checking in with me, and just holding me accountable. Am I drinking enough water? Did I exercise? And sure enough, got on that trip. 3 months later, I was down about 25 pounds, and it started that journey to that health journey, and that little light bulb moment, aha, of like, I think we've got something here business-wise as well.
And how did that evolve from sort of, you know, that light bulb moment to creating a structure for a business?
Well, the funny thing is that even though I know so much about health, I've spent the past 15 years in healthcare working for hospital organizations, other startups around diabetes, and I've seen great tools out there, but the one tool that was not there was the engagement for people and how do you engage on a personal level. And this program follows a clinical model of helping men along a journey. And it's not about taking out an app and saying, hey, I'm going to lose 20 pounds in 30 days, because that doesn't work. People will sign up on a Sunday, they start on a Monday, and then they quit on Friday. This is a path of slow and steady progress with small changes that help build a foundation and ensure a lifelong of change.
So you started a little bit telling us some of the snippets of what's included within the program. What are those kind of key core components that are included within this?
Well, the program starts you out, as I said, on a journey. And in essence, we like to think of it as different buckets of information. So you've got messaging that comes out to you with, you know, motivation and positive moments and really helping with mental health. Also with food changes, exercise. We don't recommend one particular program, but we just want you to make a change. And DadBod has a lot of rules that we instill with men as well. You're going out on a date for the weekend? Well, don't have two entrees and appetizers. You basically split a couple appetizers and then share an entree. And that's one of our rules. If you don't want to quit drinking alcohol, that's fine. Double your glass with soda water and slow down the process. All of these small changes equate to a small caloric change, which over time, week, month, will reduce basically the pounds that you've got on.
One of the things that you mentioned, you know, is that you have a buddy that's, you know, kind of helping you become accountable. I'm assuming this is not something that men typically talk about in their friend group.
Men do not talk about it at all. The level of men talking about it was when I'm playing golf and guys see me and like, oh, what'd you do to get in shape? I got to do that. And they got a gut, and but they also have a six pack of beer in their cart as well. And they're not walking, they're driving on the cart. So for better or for worse. But that's the main thing that men do not talk about it. And if you look at the health market and health apps out there, the market today is an $8 billion industry. By 2030, it's expected to be $35 billion. 75% of that is geared towards women. Men are really underserved in this market and looking for help. And the most help that guys get is they have to download an app and track everything that they ate on a daily basis. And our program uses AI, where we take snapshots of photos and make it very simple for men to just engage.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. Okay, if I sign up for the program, what's the first thing that's going to happen, and what's going to happen on a daily basis?
So basically, at the starting point, you sign up, you answer three simple questions about a goal, what you're looking for, and we start you on that journey. And it doesn't start out day one saying, throw everything out in your pantry, and this is what you're going to eat. It really starts with a journey of like, hey, what are you going to eat for lunch? Okay, well, let's make one substitution for that lunch. That substitution could be 300 calories. 300 calories over a week is 2,100 calories. In a month, 8,000. That's a little more than 2 pounds. One simple change is all we're talking about.
How big a deal is alcohol in this equation?
It's very big. The number one reason men have put on weight is alcohol relation.
Well, and I think in some ways, too, there's also a mental component of alcohol as well. And I don't want to say the word like self-fulfilling prophecy, but if you're not feeling well and you're drinking alcohol, you're not going to feel better.
You're absolutely right. And mental health and where your mental state is something that we really focus on, because most people, when they start a short-term program, they're all jazzed up. They see an ad, they love it, and they want to start. This program realizes, and most people know, that to make change, it's your mindset needs to change. And we help people with that mindset.
When I go to the DadBod Bootcamp website, I see a lot of articles and information. How did you find those experts that helped pull this program together?
Well, with my background in diabetes, I've been working in this field for 15 years. So these are people that I've worked with over the years. And quite honestly, everyone, once we started launching and building our founders group, which we're doing now, it's been exciting because everyone wants to jump on board and really help us and assist us.
Because this is a business show, I have to ask you about a pricing structure and what your business model looks like.
So right now, during our founders group buildup, it's absolutely free. So people can go to the dadbodbootcamp.com website, sign up for free. We've got a great giveaway with Ian, spending a weekend in Beverly Hills with him for free. But after that, we have a subscription model. It'll be $19.95 a month, which is among the low end of the cost structure for that. And that includes all the basic programming that you'll get for helping you with mental health, with alcohol, with food. And as time goes on, we'll add other tracks to it as well. So as an example, we're coaching a few people now that are on semaglutide. And there's a whole semaglutide track that we will add to the program as well to fine-tune your results and also help you not stay on it forever as well.
Speaking of other things you'd like to add to the program, knowing that you're just doing the Founders Club and you're launching this, what else do you see adding to the community as it continues to grow?
Well, We're doing an event this summer, which is going to be pretty exciting, and it's a mocktail and pairing event. So we were actually invited to a pre-SB party in July in Beverly Hills, and there's going to be a lot of athletes, coaches, which is great because athletes, once they're done with their career, they do need modifications as well. So we're going to be doing a whole pairing event there and just showing people that, hey, you can enjoy a cocktail or a non-alcoholic drink and food that is not going to be 500 or 600 calories. Like, we've got great cocktails that are 40 calories.
And so it's one of the things that the site will have is some sort of specific dietary recommendations, you know, to point you to better kinds of food choices?
Yeah, part of it is definitely education. It's educating people on the right foods to eat and the foods that we should stay away from. For me, I know, like, I can't have one slice of pizza. Like, pizza is just a hard one for me. So we educate people and then allow them to make their own choices and not want to transform them into saying, oh, you can only bring this food in from a mail order company. It's really about taking the food that you like and modifying it.
So as we wrap up in the last 30 seconds, let our listeners know how they can find out more.
Okay, so a couple great ways to reach us. First, our website, dadbodbootcamp.com. You can follow us on Instagram, where we're posting every day on it, and that'll be dadbod_bootcamp. And if you want to reach us individually, you can always email us at bro@dadbodbootcamp.com.
I see that you include humor as part of this, which I'm sure is appreciated.
Oh, big time. And all our messaging is all polished by comedians as well. So it's the way guys talk to each other. So
how fun. Well, we've been speaking with David Greenholtz with the Dad Bod Bootcamp. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. If you like Mountain Money, let us know. Please leave a review.